Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome, everyone, to a brand new series of Motorsport Podcasts. Many of you will have listened to our Engineering Formula One Drivers series with the likes of Patrick Head, Adrian Newey, and Gordon Murray earlier this year. I'm delighted to bring you the next set of recordings. This time, we turn our attention to the Scuderia, the Formula One team that's so famous, it's simply referred to as the team. Founded in 1939 and a constant on the F1 grid since that first World Championship in 1950, Ferrari is the team that every driver wants to race for. 221 pole positions, 253 fastest laps, 238 Grand Prix victories, and let's not forget the 16 Formula One World Championships. For all its success and wonderful history, though, Ferrari has always been a tricky place to work. Many drivers have left or been unceremoniously kicked out after little more than a season. What is Ferrari like to drive for? And what of Enzo himself? In this series of podcasts, we speak to the men who know best, those lucky few who have driven for Ferrari during their Formula One careers. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Motorsport Podcast. I'm Ed Foster, and we have a very special recording for you today as part of our Driving for Ferrari series. A very warm welcome to Felipe Massa. Felipe, thank you so much for joining us all the way from Brazil.
Hi, Ed. Yes, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Yes, I'm in Brazil. So actually, I'm here with the family, especially in this little tricky situation that's happening all around the world. So, but I'm really happy, you know, to participate and I just to have a nice chat with you. To speak about something which is a big pleasure for me, which is Ferrari, that I'm really Ferrarista since a long time ago. So it's a big pleasure for me.
Yeah. So before we wind the clock back and kind of go back to your early career, what are your racing plans at the moment? Because I know you stopped Formula E, but you've done a round of the Endurance Series in Brazil. What's the plan at the moment?
Yeah, so I decided to stop with Formula E. Definitely, I really love the championship. It's a really nice championship to participate. Big challenge, racing the nice places, great tracks. Even the tight and the challenge, for all of the drivers. I think I decided to stop. I'm planning maybe to go back to live in Brazil with the family. And so I did few endurance race here in Brazil, which is a race that they put some professional drivers, together with some, amateur drivers. And I'm doing this race here, but I'm preparing to maybe go back to Brazil and looking forward maybe to racing stock car in Brazil. And also having my time for other things as well, for business and for my family.
It's interesting that you're going back to closed cockpit cars, because your father raced touring cars as an amateur in Brazil, didn't he?
Yeah, my father started to race in the touring cars, a long time ago, but just for fun, not professionally, And I wanted to be for sure a racing driver because of my father, So I wanted to do the same as what he was doing. Definitely. I managed to be professional and racing also in the dream category, which is the Formula One, and also be successful there. Actually, I was kind of planning maybe to race in the touring cars, but maybe end of my career, for sure professionally, but also for having some fun as well, doing something that I really enjoy, which is racing. And and the time is passing, but I think, you know, you can never stop doing what you love to do, which is racing. And that's why I'm planning to do that here in Brazil.
Do you, I mean, you obviously, you had such a long career in Formula One, then you had a very steep learning curve going to Formula E, and which is sort of very specialist cars. How have you found it sort of going to a, you know, a GT3 car, or, you know, or to these stock cars? What's the jump like when you spent so long in Formula One?
Well, for sure, it's a different challenge, you know. So it's completely different cars, completely different behave. So you need to learn how to drive this type of cars, for sure, which maybe takes a little bit of time. But it's the same in Formula E. Formula E is completely different than anything else that that I drove before, you know. So it's definitely a massive challenge, and you need to learn everything. Even I think it's even a bigger change, you know, going from like Formula One to Formula E instead of going from like Formula One to touring cars, you know, because I think the mentality of the touring cars, even if it's completely different cars, completely different behave, the mentality of the racing tracks, the mentality of you know, the of the category, you know, is more similar, I would say, compared to Formula E, which is completely different, you know. So that's why I also decided to have this new challenge as well.
Now, am I right that you went to, your father took you to practice at Interlagos, Formula One practice, in 1986 and 7? Was it around about that time that you watched? And that was your first taste of Formula One, wasn't it? And what a first taste, to kind of Prost, Senna, Piquet, Mansell, you know, amazing to see all of them.
Yeah, and actually on that time, I mean, we came to watch. Actually, it was like, it was not even the race. It was like the free practice and the qualifying. And we went to the track. I remember so well, we were in the grandstand, and we went there to watch Piquet. So Piquet was racing still, maybe on that time for Benetton or maybe Williams, I think, you know. So we were there to see him, and I remember so well. So I was completely crazy in the grandstand, and then we came back to watch Senna. Which was maybe beginning of 90s, you know. So, and then we came back also to watch Barrichello in the grandstand in the same place. So, it's so amazing, you know, because you have an idea. And I remember so well, you know, the idea by being like a fan, you know, like being there to support the drivers, but also to see the Formula One. And it was like a dream, you know, and and then, I mean, we were also thinking, it would be a dream to be here racing for Formula One, you know. So then I managed to be there, you know, racing for Formula One, and also to be there racing for Ferrari, and also to be there winning, you know, for Ferrari, you know, a couple of times, which was just an amazing situation.
When did you, I mean, you know, we'll talk more about your sort of your early career in a bit, but when did you start thinking, hang on, I think I can actually make it to Formula One? Because you obviously, you had lots of success in karting, and then, you know, did single seaters, which very quickly, you know, you won all the championships, you won Formula 3000. But I think long before then, you were getting calls from Formula One teams. Was there a moment when you thought, hang on, I can do this?
Well, I think in the karting, not. Because, I mean, karting is still, you know, far away, you know, compared to Formula One. So it's still, you're still doing your learning, you know, career. But the biggest problem I always had, it was sponsor, you know. So my father helped me in the karting. For sure, at the beginning, not like, you know, spending money, but like helping me there. But then on the end of my career in the karting, we didn't have like money anymore. So my father was helping me with a lot of, he was struggling, you know, to help me. And so I was racing like with a chassis that somebody gave to me, you know, so engine that, you know, you see drivers with like five engines. I had maybe two, you know. So at the end, it was, you know, surviving situation, you know. So then when I moved to the Formula Chevrolet, which it was like the Formula Opel in Europe. So it was the Formula Chevrolet in Brazil. So I moved to, I managed to race for a team that it was never successful, you know. It was not winning championships or races, you know. but it was a team that they had a little bit of sponsor to help. Also 98, I didn't have the money to do the whole championship. So I did only the second part of the championship, which was like my first experience, you know. Just going back a little bit before, in 97, I didn't have money to race in the cars. And I wanted to race. And my father said, you know what? You can choose all your race in the karting one more year in the situation you have, or you do 4 tests in Formula Chevrolet. So you choose. And then I choose to do 4 tests in Formula Chevrolet and not race in the karting in 97. You know? So then 98, I was trying to race, but I couldn't do the first part of the championship. So I do only the second part of the championship when, you know, I got this team that he was helping me. So, and then I finished 5th in the championship. The year after, 99, I did the whole championship and I won the championship, so the Brazilian championship. So then it was the time to go to Europe. So until this time, I was not really sure that, I mean, Formula One was close. You know, I said, okay, maybe the chance starts to increase, you know, winning the championship, showing my performance in the track. But I mean, you need to go to Europe, you know. So then I managed to go to Formula Renault. So and everybody was saying, you need to go to England, you know, you need to race in UK, otherwise it will be difficult to, you know, to show yourself, you know, to go to Formula One. And I tried to speak, you know, with the teams in England, but it was too expensive, you know, to race in UK. So then we moved to Italy. So I was talking to teams there and I managed to find a team that they were good team, but not like a team that he was winning everything. And I had money to do 6 races of the Italian championship in the Formula Renault. And they accept me that. And then also they were giving me 2 races of the European, which was in the 2 races in the same place as the Italian. So then, I mean, I start, you know, I was doing pretty well in the practice, you know, like a record of the tracks, you know, and then we start the season and I was winning the first races. And also the second race was Italian European in the same place in Monza, and I won both. So on that time, I was kind of, you know, winning both, you know, fighting for both championships. And at the end of the year, I won both championships, you know, so I managed to stay a little bit more help, money here, money there. And I managed to win both championships, Italian and European, which was something that it never happens, you know, a driver winning both championships in the same year. So after I won, you know, the Formula Renault European Italian Championship, then I was sure things was changing. So that time I was, maybe, you know what, maybe I can have a chance to go to Formula One, because then it starts to have many Formula One teams behind me. You know, yeah. To sign like a young contract, you know, for the team.
Yeah.
And at the end, on that time when I won the Formula Renault, I said, okay, maybe now things is changing, and maybe I can go to Formula One.
It's interesting, isn't it? That, you know, you were leading both championships without the money to actually finish the season. Nowadays,
yeah,
you know, if you spoke to young drivers, I just, you know, if any driver that's leading the championship, they wouldn't be in that situation. You know, the world is so different now. You know, you did get quite an early call from Ferrari, and you were introduced to Jean Todt. This is forwarding to when you're in Formula 3000. He was quite sort of quite blunt on his sort of first conversation with you.
Yeah. Oh, actually, the story is even a little bit longer than that, because I had Briatore trying to get me, you know, as a young driver. And actually, he was there on my last race in Valencia of the Italian European Championship in Formula Renault, because he was part of the Renault team, Formula One team, and he was Formula Renault. So he was there to sign the contract with me. And I have Toyota as well. So I did few Formula 3 tests for Toyota with Prema on that time that they made the deal with Prema. And I had also Pedro Palodini's, which he has a Prost team on that moment. And he is also Brazilian. So he wanted to get me under contract, you know. So actually, I was going to the Formula 3000 team. And And all of this contract, they were signing to me, but I have to go to Formula 3. And I had a deal with the owner of the Formula 3000 team, Adriano Morini. And Adriano said, no, I want you to race in Formula 3000, not Formula 3. So actually, he made me say no to Briatore, to Pedro Paulo Diniz, to Toyota. And I said, no, how can I say no? I mean, I signed even whatever contract, you know, with the people from Formula 1, I signed. No, you need to trust me, you know, you need to say no, you cannot sign. All right, I said no, you know, to all of them. And I started to do some testing in Formula 3000 on his team. And he started to do really, really, really well. And he managed to have a contact with somebody that he knew. And this guy has an Italian company, Lineotex, and he sponsored Ferrari in the past. And this guy said, oh, I know Ferrari people, maybe I can organize a meeting with Jean Todt. So then he organized a meeting with Jean Todt, with me, and I went there, I put my tie, and you know, and I went to Ferrari to see Jean Todt, to have a meeting with him, me and Adriano Morini. And then it happens exactly what you said. So he said, oh, you know what? Actually, I mean, he made hundreds of questions, you know, to me, to understand about me and about my family, about everything. And he said, you know what? We are not interesting, you know, to have you under the contract. I already heard about you, about your name. But for the moment, we are not interesting. But I will tell you one thing. So you do the Formula 3000 championship. If you win the championship, you come back here and then we speak on the better way. So if you don't win, forget it. But if you win, you come back here and we speak. Okay? I said, okay, thank you. It was great to be there anyway. And then, you know, I did the whole championship and he asked Morini he said, I want to know everything that he is doing this year, all of the testing, racing, telemetry. So I want you to send everything to Ferrari and we will analyze him the whole year. For sure, this I didn't know. So, and then I did the championship and Ferrari, you know, was analyzing everything that I was doing the whole season. And then at the end of the season, I won the championship. I came back to Ferrari and we signed the deal for 8 years contract. And actually it was a secret. So I signed a contract with Ferrari for 8 years as a young driver, which never happens before. But it was secret. I couldn't tell anybody, only for sure my family. And can imagine, I mean, a guy with 19 years old, you know, signing the contract with Ferrari and cannot say, cannot tell anybody. It was really harsh with me, but it was just an amazing situation, yeah, as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously you won those championships in Italy. You won the Formula 3000 championship, first time of asking. Your results and telemetry and everything spoke kind of for themselves. But do you think the kind of the Brazilian history with Formula One, with the likes of Senna, of Rubens, you know, Piquet, do you think that history helps some young Brazilian drivers at all? Because I'm sure in England, I think it does help as well. Yeah. But I don't know whether that's like that in Brazil.
I think it's the same. For sure it helps. I mean, definitely. I think, you know, Brazilian people, normally we are, everybody likes Brazilian people as well. I mean, we have a kind of, you know, a good way of being, you know, to the people. And I think, you know, it's a country that, you know, even from outside, many people say, ah, you are Brazilian. Ah, nice. People likes Brazilian people anyway. But I think, you know, it definitely helps. I mean, we had a great history in Formula One, many championships with Fittipaldi, Piquet, Senna. But also on that time as well, I mean, every category, Formula 3, Formula whatever, you know, category on that time, it was a Brazilian fighting for the championship and winning races, you know. So definitely Brazil was really strong. And I think the history of Brazilian people, of Brazilian champions, you know, important drivers, definitely helps. Like is like in England now, but also especially when you have a driver like Hamilton, you know, driving like Nigel Mansell, but a driver like you know, Michael Schumacher, for example, I mean, what he made in Germany, you know, it helps definitely a lot of drivers, you know, after, you know, everything that he was doing as well, you know. So I think that's definitely very important.
Yeah. And you mentioned there that you were only 19 when you signed this contract for Ferrari. What was going through your mind? Because Ferrari at that stage was just kind of in the beginning / middle of its kind of utter dominance at the start of the turn of the century. This for a 19-year-old guy who'd come over from Brazil to Italy, this was literally the best outcome. You know, and to go to Fiorano, to go to Maranello must have been kind of slightly mind-blowing for someone who'd only really had 3 or 4 seasons of car racing under their belt.
Well, I think, you know, every young driver, you know, that he goes to Maranello gets crazy because it's just amazing, you know, to go there and to see Ferrari. I remember, you know, when I was a kid, and Brazil is not a country that you see a lot of Ferraris in the road, you know. So, but I mean, I remember when I see a Ferrari in the road, it was like amazing. I mean, I see a Ferrari car, so you do like a lot of pictures, you know. So it's like a, you know, a proper dream, you know, like a very important, you know, it's a very important thing. And then, I mean, you race all your career, you know, and you see also in television, you know, Ferrari, it was also the time that Ferrari was winning everything, you know. So when you see in the television, Ferrari is just amazing. They're winning everything. And then I go there, you know, and I see, you know, the Ferrari factory, you know, I see like I sit it, you know, in the office of the boss, you know, of Ferrari, you know, with all of the details, you know, in the wall, the little cars, you know, the history, you know, the pictures and the history, you know, going around the factory and see the people working. But it's just amazing. I mean, it's difficult to explain the feeling, you know, that, a driver, you know, a young driver, a kid or whatever, you know, feel when you go to Maranello. And, you know, also is a very important point because in the Fiorano circuit, you have a little house. And in this little house is where normally the drivers stay. Now you have even rooms and for the drivers to stay there, to sleep there. It's like a little hotel. But is the house, you know, that... Enzo Ferrari had his office, you know, there. And when you enter, you know, you see the office in the way they left the office like it was, you know, like it's like a very special, you know, area that they kept like it was when he was there working, you know. So I see many people, you know, all my time with Ferrari already, a racing driver, but I see many people entering that house and couldn't stop crying, you know. Many people like proper fans. But even people with money, like fans that, you know, they paying, you know, to go to Fiorano to drive his old Ferrari or also to drive his Formula One Ferrari, because they allow the people to go there for sure, paying, you know, to stay there and to see and to visit and everything else. And I see many people crying that couldn't stop crying because it's so important, so special, you know. And you can imagine, you know, like when a young driver, you know, goes to the factory and see all of that. It was just, I mean, I couldn't really believe. And I remember everything, you know, all the details. And it was just amazing.
Did you know, you drove for Ferrari for so long. Did that ever wear off? You know, even in those kind of final few seasons, was it still special going to Maranello? Or did it by then it had become a bit more normal?
It was always special. Definitely. After, you know, a long, long time, especially me, I'm lucky that I raced for Ferrari 8 years. You know, I was inside that factory for more than 10 years, you know. So, and for me, it was just a dream, you know. It was just fantastic feeling all the time that you're going to Maranello. Not only the factory, because after a while you get used, you know, to working there. You're going there not only in the amazing moments, but you're going there in the difficult moments as well, you know, when maybe things is not going so well in the season, or maybe you had a bad race or whatever. So you have all the two different ways, you know, to celebrate, but also to work hard in the difficult time. So, but what is especially Maranello is that you go there, you have like a Montana restaurant, which is the restaurant very close to the factory. that it's very traditional, you know. So you always, I was always going there to have lunch or dinner with Rossella and Maurizio, which is, you know, they is their restaurant, you know, and it's very family, you know. And then you have also the Cavallino restaurant. So you, it's, you know, you create like, you know, your own things that maybe you're doing in your house, in your town, you know. So I think this is very special, you know, because you're there to work, but then you're going to have a lunch in the place that you feel like if you are at home, you know, dinner as well. So you feel really part of the family, you know. And I think this is something that you only have in Ferrari, you know. And for me, this is something that is so special, you know, like you getting there, but you really feel you part of the family. And this is difficult to find in another team, you know, this type of feeling, I would say.
Because you obviously, you had your seasons for, you know, with Sauber, which we can come and talk about. Was there a noticeable difference when you became a full, because you were the reserve driver, you know, for a year.
Yeah.
But when you became a full-time Ferrari driver, did your experience in Italy change dramatically? Because we chatted to Ivan Capelli a few weeks ago, and he was saying that he drove up to sign his contract, stopped at a petrol station, no one knew who he was. He drove back, stopped at the same petrol station, and he was just surrounded by people. And he said it just happened like that. And did you find kind of, you know, your relationship with Italians in Italy change after that?
Ah, for sure. It's just amazing. I mean, definitely when I signed for Ferrari, people kind of knew me, you know, because I was already a Ferrari test driver. I was already a Formula One driver, so I was racing for Sauber anyway. So people kind of knew me. But when I signed for Ferrari, it was just amazing. I mean, everywhere you go in Italy, everywhere you pass, like in the auto grill restaurant in the highway, it's just amazing. I mean, people really look you and people really want to touch you, because the Italian people, they need to touch you. They need to hang you, and they need even to kiss you, you know, so they need to touch you. And it's just amazing. I mean, the feeling on that is just fantastic. I mean, I am also Italian, you know, my family is Italian also, from the south of Italy. And I speak Italian, so I speak better Italian than English, you know. So, and I think also that this is also a big help for the Italian fans, you know, for the Italian people. So I went a couple of times to Cerignola in the south of Italy, which is like the place of my family, you know, in the past. And they received me like 4,000 people on the piazza, you know. And it's just amazing, you know, the feeling that you feel, the feeling that you have by being Ferrari driver, but also from the fans. And this is just like a religion, you know. Ferrari is like a religion, and you cannot find in another team, even if you can win the championships, you can be famous, but that religion is impossible to find in another team.
There's the other side of it, isn't there? That I've heard about from some of the other Ferrari drivers in the series, that, you know, it was Ferrari, exactly as you said, is just this kind of mystical being in Italy. But with that, with the sort of great support also comes great expectation. And if things aren't going well, as you've got the Gazzetta dello Sport, you know, the kind of the sports newspaper that does not hold back if something's not going right. I think also the Italians are obviously so passionate about Ferrari. If it's not going right, then the drivers are sometimes people they look towards. Did you have that, and how did you cope with that side of it?
Yes. I mean, Ferrari, I think in the good side, you know, like we were talking before, it's just an amazing feeling by being a Ferrari driver. But in the professional side, you know, in the working side, in the racing side, in the media side, it's just... you know, you have a lot of up and downs, you know, even if you win or not winning, you know, sometimes every day is like, the expectation is so high from the media, from all of this, newspaper, like Gazzetta dello Sport, but also, all of them, you know, so every day is a big expectation. So, and the biggest problem actually for Ferrari is that, because you know, so many moments, I mean, we found the direction to go. I mean, we start to improve things, and then maybe one bad race, or maybe one really bad situation, you can change the direction of the working, you know. And I remember so well, so it was so difficult to keep Montezemolo relaxed, you know. And actually, I mean, to be honest, the only way to keep him relaxed, it was with the result. But, you know, the best manager to keep Montezemolo relaxed, especially after he had some results, because even before it was so difficult, it was Jean Todt. Jean Todt was the only one that he could manage to keep Montezemolo relaxed, even in the difficult situation, even if, even with the difficult results. So he managed to find a way by, you know, pushing the team on the working the right time. So after that, you know, with the, you know, difficult years, Ferrari not winning for a long time, which is actually the situation now, is tricky. And I think maybe the media sometimes can put the team, you know, going to the wrong side. And for me, this is the it was always a difficult situation to manage, you know, in Ferrari. And is it still like that for the moment?
Now, if you're looking for more Ferrari content, then you may well be interested in Motorsport's latest publication. Ferrari, From Race to Road, celebrates the journey of the world's most famous car brand and its unique place in motor racing history. Using Motorsport's unmatched archive of stories and photographs, we trace the Ferrari story from its early days under Enzo right up to date, with interviews with current F1 star Charles Leclerc and F1 team boss Mattia Binotto. Along the way, we celebrate some of the all-time classic race cars, including the wonderful 1975 312T and races such as the Targa Florio. Plus, we test some of the greatest Ferrari road cars. Illustrated with world-class photographs and wonderful writing, Ferrari From Race to Road is a must-have for all fans of the marque. It's on sale now in all good newsagents, or you can buy it via the Motorsport website, which is motorsportmagazine.com. And so do you think, I mean, obviously there were lots of things to kind of Michael Schumacher, Rubens and Ferrari's success in the early 2000s, notably, you know, the Schumacher-Braun-Todd axis. But I guess obviously the Todd, Jean being able to just relax Luca de Montezemolo and keep him away was probably a large part of that success.
Yeah. Yeah, because I mean, if you see Michael signed with Ferrari 96, if I'm not wrong, no? And he had a very difficult time, 97, 98, 99. So it was not easy. So, and I'm sure in this, you know, 3-4 years, they had a massive problems, you know, inside. Even the problems to maybe fire Jean Todt, you know? So, and I think they managed to keep the difficult situation and to get the right people around the team and to get the people that he was able to build the right car, you know. But before that, even with Jean Todt, even with Michael, it was not easy, you know. So that's why I think they managed with the result, but they managed, you know, with the code mentality to keep Montezemolo in the right range, you know. Yeah. So then after that, for sure, they create the massive team and they win many years of the championship. But we also won, you know, after that, like 2007, 2008, it was also the last years that Ferrari won the championships. And I think it was still different teams, you know, different people working, but it was still a good help from that time, you know. So... but then, I mean, for sure, with so many years, you know, with not winning, I mean, without the result, you know, the people expecting, you know, things start to change and the media starts to push really hard as well.
Yeah. When you arrived for your sort of, I suppose, that year of being a third driver, I know you had signed for Ferrari, you know, before then as a young driver. You were the third driver to Michael and Rubens. You'd done a season with Sauber. That must have been a huge learning curve that year to work with Michael and Rubens and that kind of what I referred to it as a super team. You know, it was, yeah, it was the pinnacle. And it must have been quite different going from cyber to then being kind of enveloped in Ferrari. It must have been quite an experience.
It was a massive change for me, even if I did the year with the Sauber. And actually, I mean, I scored many points with Sauber on that year. And I mean, don't forget that on that year, the points was like top six. So it was so difficult to score points, you know, on my first year, you know, in Formula One. And I did many seven places as well. Result, you know, I finished seventh many times, eighth, which now is points, you know, important points as well. But for sure, I was crashing a little bit too much. You know, I was a little bit wild. You know, I was, you know, missing a bit of experience. And then Peter Sauber decided to change for like an experienced driver like Frentzen. And I had the chance to be 1 year as a test driver in Ferrari. And that year was a massive change for me. So I managed to learn a lot. And I managed to drive every week I was driving. I was testing. And I was going to all of the races. I was participating to all of the meetings, you know, with Michael, with Rubens. And definitely that year was a big help for my career. You know, it just helped me a lot on my experience to know what to say, to know how to work with the team. And I think after that, I went back to Sauber and it was completely different. It was, you know, definitely a big step forward to be 1 year test driver of Ferrari.
Yeah. How was your first test with Sauber? Was that, because obviously you'd done a season of Formula 3000, but was that quite a big leap? Because, you know, you do hear even from GP2 to Formula One nowadays, there's still that big jump. Did you find that when you first, because of V10 Sauber, it would have been quite something to drive?
Yeah, for sure. It was a massive jump. Definitely even bigger than what is Formula 2 now to Formula 1. I think it's much closer than how it was on that time. So it was a massive jump. My first testing Sauber was end of 2001 in the Mugello, which was definitely a very, very difficult, physically, a very difficult track. So, but I remember, I mean, it was so good. I was really competitive. I was really quick. And actually, I managed to do the best lap time what Sauber had in Mugello on my first 2 days of testing. And I, for sure, I had some mistakes, you know, I spun a few times, but I showed that, I mean, I have the capacity, you know, to be in Formula One, you know, I had the talent to be in Formula One. And I remember, so it was just an amazing feeling. And I was so, it was so difficult physically for me. So I remember on the first day I did 50 laps and I couldn't really turn to the side, you know, for my neck. So it was so, and to drive the day after, it was just so difficult, you know, to do the first few laps. For sure, after, you know, I warm up a bit, it was a bit better, but at the beginning it was so tough. But anyway, I managed to really just show what I was able to do.
Now we've got some readers' questions. Bruno wrote in asking about the departure of Ross and Jean Todt. So we've sort of answered that one. There's one here from Ben Johnson. There's quite a sort of open question, but I think it's quite nice because he sort of touched on some of the negative side of being a Ferrari driver. And he's asking, what are the internal politics at Ferrari actually like? Everyone always seems to talk about the team politics at Ferrari. You've obviously raced for other teams. You race with Sauber, you race with Williams. Is it worse than other teams? Or is that just really a bit of a myth that gets spun out?
I think it's, especially on that time. I mean, on that time we had Michael Schumacher, that, I mean, he won many seasons for Ferrari, so he had the team on his pocket. Definitely, I mean, it was a team that, I mean, we are here to win, and we are here to support, you know, the driver that we really need to support. So, which on that time was Schumacher, you know, and definitely Michael deserved it because, I mean, he was just an amazing driver, you know, he was just a driver that he was, you know, capable to win, capable to, you know, put the team on his back. But I mean, the political it was always part of the team. It was always part of the mentality, you know, of the team, especially with Michael. It was so difficult, you know, it was impossible to fight against the political. But with Kimi, I think the team was completely open, you know, for both drivers, you know, and he, you know, even 2007, I mean, we had a deal that until Spa race, you know, you're free to fight. After Spa, we decide who will be the number one driver. And I, actually, the race before Spa was Monza. I was in front in the championship of Kimi. And I was also in front of him in the race. I was going to finish second or third, and Kimi was fourth. Unfortunately, I had to retire on that race. For sure, we went to Spa already. I was like 2 points behind Kimi in the championship. I supposed to be like maybe 8 points in front of him, you know. So at the end, I was a bit unlucky, you know, with that situation. But also 2008, the team was completely, you know, open, you know, for both drivers. And that year, I fight for the championship. But then after with Alonso, things change a little bit, you know. So the politics starts to go back, like, for example, how it was when Michael was there, you know. And it was so difficult to fight against the political. It was so difficult to fight against what the team, you know, already put in the paper even before the championship start. So it was always a part of Ferrari. And for sure now, I mean, it's so difficult for me to say is exactly like that or not, because I'm not working for the team. But I think it was always part of the mentality of the team to have like a political, strong political inside the mentality of the team.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I suppose, you know, your relationship with Alonso kind of it came to a head really in the press anyway to Hockenheim in 2010. But was there a number one and number two driver when you and Fernando were driving together, or was it the same deal whereas whoever's ahead at a certain point of the season would then be supported?
It was the same deal I had with Michael. It was the same deal I had with Kimi, and it was the same deal I had with Fernando. Even if he is not, you don't see in the contract written, you are number two drivers, you know, but you have some clause in the contract that, I mean, you need to do what the team, you know, want. Like, I mean, you need to follow,
yeah,
you know,
covers the, everything. Yeah.
You know, you need to follow the instructions of the team. And the instructions of the team, you know, can means many things, you know, inside. So at the end, you know, you are not number two driver. But if the team is saying, I mean, the instruction is to do this or to do that, you need to follow. This is inside the contract. Is inside the contract for Michael Schumacher, and is inside the contract for Fernando Alonso as well. But definitely the instruction is to favor them, you know.
Yeah. It's interesting, I mean, because that Hungary was, you know, it was early in the season, really. How, as a driver, do you come back from being told, you know, Fernando's that famous radio call from Rob, you know, Fernando's faster than you. How do you come back from that? Because it's obviously a very difficult thing when you, as you said just then, both of you have the same clause, but you suddenly know for certain that the team is just behind this other driver. It must be such a difficult thing to go on and you know, carry on winning after that.
It is, for sure it is. I think for the mentality, you know, of the driver, you know, for your the strongness, you know, that you need to have in your mind, confidence, especially, I mean, for the confidence of the driver is so tough, because I mean, you just put you in the on the side. You feel that you are, you know, the team is putting you on the side. The team needs you anyway, you know, because your points is so important for the team. And the Ferrari teams is looking massively for the Constructors Championship, you know, massively. So even compared to many other teams, I think Ferrari is the team that they really, the Constructors Championship is really important for them, you know. You feel, you know, after this type of situation, I mean, race that it happened, that, I mean, the team is asking you to let them by. This is really, you know, bad for the confidence of the driver.
Yeah, so. It was. I'm pretty sure it was Rubens who was once asked, you know, why do you not go and be a number one at another team, you know, rather than being number two at Ferrari? And he said, well, I'm better being number two here than number one anywhere else for my results.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's, you know, that, you know, that's something you think about as well.
But I think if you have a competitive car, and if you are in the competitive team, so you know that, I mean, you can have a better result there than the, what you can have in another team. Depends on which team you are talking, you know, as well, you know. So maybe if you are in the top team and, you know, another team that is fighting for the fifth position in the Constructors Championship, Ford, wants to have you, you know that, I mean, the you go back, you know. So definitely is true, you know. So at the end, you're looking for being on the best team, for sure, you know. You can struggle a little bit, but you're looking for being in the best team, and you can be better than being in another team that you won't be able to win the championship or to win even races, you know?
Yeah. Now, I wanted to look back at 2008 into Lagos, that amazing weekend you had, pole position, fastest lap, race win. You did absolutely everything you could that weekend to win the world championship. You're on home soil, and everyone knows the story that you had the championship for a few seconds, and then Lewis got past Timo Glock coming out of the final corner. Just tell me a little bit about kind of what was going through your head, because I'm sure you quadrupled the Felipe Massa fan base that weekend with just the kind of the dignity that you had on the podium after such what can only be described as the sport's greatest roller coaster ride.
Well, on that race, I think everything just working perfectly, you know. So I was so strong mentally at home, on my track, on my place. So I could feel really the strongness of the Brazilian fans. So I could feel that what I want, the team wants as well. So I think, you know, the all of the practice, qualifying, race, every lap I did on that weekend, it was just, you know, under control. And so I was so strong, you know, to fight for that championship, you know, and mentally with everybody together with me. So it was just, you know, that for how I am here, you know, I will not lose the race. So I will win the race for sure, because everything is really just perfectly in the whatever condition, dry, wet, whatever, doesn't matter, you know. So everything was just perfect, you know. Everything was just, you know, set for me to win that race, for the team as well. So, and it's unbelievable how, you know, how strong I was on the start, how strong I was in the grid, and how I managed to put, you know, the Brazilian force inside me, you know. So, and but I mean, for sure, things didn't work in the perfect way, not because of me or not because of the team on that race, for whatever thing that it happens before that race, that is so many things happens on that season, you know, unfortunately for me to lose points, you know, and it was just that weekend, it was just amazing feeling and, you know, amazing strongness I have inside me, you know.
Do you subscribe to Nigel Mansell's philosophy that you're, you know, a second a lap faster or half a second a lap faster at your home Grand Prix, because you've always gone so well into Lagos? Do you believe that?
I believe that for sure. I definitely believe that, and I believe that it's unbelievable when you fight in your home, you know, in your place, you are strong. You're stronger, yeah. You know, because I think, you know, it happens the same in the football, you know, it happens the same in so many different sports. When you play home, you play better, you know, and it's difficult to explain why, because, I mean, you try everything in the best way, even in the places that is not your, it's away, you know, from your home.
Yeah.
But, I mean, when you are at home, you know, for whatever situation, for whatever reason, things is really better.
When I was working at Goodwood, I interviewed Martin Johnson, the 2003 England Rugby World Captain, Rugby World Cup captain. And I asked him exactly the same question, you know, why is it that rugby teams usually win at home? And he said there was a scientific study and it was all down to testosterone. So,
really?
Yeah, maybe it's that. Maybe it's that.
Maybe it's that.
So there was, I wanted to quickly talk about Monaco. Because you didn't like Monaco, but then I think it was in 2008, you put it on poll there. And I think when you walked into the press conference, you were sort of as surprised as everyone. But you did have a kind of sit down with Rob. And we did a podcast with Rob a few months ago now. But he told this story of him basically trying to persuade you to break at a certain point. What was it that you talked about to kind of get you on poll that year?
Well, for sure, I was going to say that. I mean, that maybe Rob explained you the Monaco, you know, history. Actually, and I don't know why, but I was never competitive in Monaco. You know, I was maybe driving a different way on that track. Not only related to braking. I mean, I was never bad on the braking point, but related to how to drive in the city track, how to anticipate the corners, which in a city track normally you always have a little bit of understeer car. You know, so you always need to anticipate the corners. And you always need to understand how to set up the car in the right way. So I was always struggling there. Even, I mean, 2007, I was on the podium there, but not a good race anyway. Not a good weekend I had for myself, you know, even by being in the podium. So, and 2008, I mean, together with Rob, we were discussing so much, I mean, how we will, you know, get the right car, how we will set up the car in the right way. And Rob has some good ideas, you know, like maybe to do a very, very aggressive car in the front, you know, like a very oversteer car. You can even say that. But I mean, very, a very soft front, completely different than how I was using before that in Monaco, you know. And for sure, I mean, the first laps, it was a little bit strange for me, but then I managed to keep understanding, you know, the track was improving. I was really improving. I was getting competitive. I was getting good lap times in the practice. And then suddenly I was so strong in the qualifying. You know, I was really, I did like a lap that, I don't know how I did that lap. Even Senna, you know, sometimes he was even saying, I mean, I did a lap that maybe I was not driving and God was driving. So he said many times in Monaco, you know, And I feel the similar situation that, I mean, everything was just amazing, perfectly, you know. And on that weekend, I was so strong in Monaco and I was so unlucky in the race that, I mean, the race was raining massively. And also Lewis had an accident. He hit the wall and he went to the pit stop much before he's supposed to go. And with the safety car, you know, he just put me from the back to the front, you know. And I was so unlucky because of all the situations in the rain, you know. So anyway, I was going to finish second and my team made a mistake in the pit stop. So I lost even the position to Kubica. So I finished third. Definitely together with Rob, we just invented something, you know, that I was never using. And we understood how to use. And I understood how to drive in Monaco in that year. So because of a lot of working together with Rob and Giuliano Salvi, which was also my telemetry guy. So anyway, we did a good job and definitely I learned how to drive in Monaco from that time.
But it was a different track, but you were on the podium there in Formula E. You must have had a small smile to yourself as you know when you're up
for
on the podium.
Sure. For sure, the experience helps me, you know, a lot. Even for the championship, even if I go to race there in the touring car, you know. Now maybe I will be competitive for sure.
Now, as just before, I mean, we are coming to the end, so, but I really want to talk to you about Hungary 2009 and after that. Just for everyone watching and listening, if you love these podcasts, don't forget you can subscribe to them on the website, and you can also subscribe to the YouTube channel where all these podcasts are. You can watch all the videos and the rest of the Driving for Ferrari series. So do head over there. There's loads of podcasts. So if you're enjoying this, then please sign up. Felipe, just to go back to Hungary 2009, I don't want to end on this, but because it's sort of, it's such a difficult time, I'll end on a happy note, but it was, I just want to know, I suppose, first of all, what you actually remember of it, because it was such a kind of catastrophic brain injury. I think I remember you saying, nothing. Is that right? You just don't remember anything?
Yeah, actually, that's totally right. And it's difficult to explain, you know, why. I mean, because I sometimes even think, why I don't remember? I mean, I supposed to remember, you know. So, and I don't remember. What I remember actually is that we were in the qualifying lap, and I was doing my lap time on the qualifying, and that I remember. And I arrive in the last sector, and I catch Rubens. Rubens was preparing his lap, so he was in his outlap. So I catch Rubens in the last sector, and he also disturbed me. So he didn't let me by. In the last two corners, he didn't let me by. And I lost maybe three, four tenths behind him. And I was so disappointed, you know, because these three, four tenths could have put me not passing to Q3, you know. So, and I finished my lap just completely, you know, on Rubens' toe, and Rubens was starting his lap. So then I back off a little bit. I was going a little bit slower, so he was opening a bit the gap because he was doing his lap time, and he has the fail in his car. So then I don't remember anything anymore. But I just remember that Rubens disturbed me in the last sector. After that, I don't remember anything anymore. And then only when I was in the hospital, but not when I wake up, not after I was in coma, not in the beginning. I remember like more in the last days I was in the hospital, not at the beginning.
It's interesting because Stirling Moss, when he had his, you know, his career-ending crash in 1962 at Goodwood's, always said the same thing about that weekend. He has no memory of it at all. Yeah. Do you think that not having that memory helped you get back in the simulator, get back in the Ferrari for the test at the end of that year and come back racing the following year? Did that help that you couldn't remember it?
I think so. I think it helps. It's better not to remember, you know. So a situation like that, I mean, like a big accident, you know, something that you really suffer or, you know, you really in the difficult time, it's better not to remember, you know. So especially when you work in the job that you have a lot of risks, you know. So at the end, I think it's positive. I mean, think the human being sometimes is just amazing, you know, how things happen, and is definitely for your mind is better, definitely, not to remember.
Were you a different driver at all when you came back?
Not on driving, actually. Not on the everything I was doing before driving, all the, you know, ticks that I have on driving, so I still had after the accident. But even many people say, I mean, you never won anymore your accident, you know, so for sure, maybe the accident changed you in something. This I cannot say. This I really cannot say, because I mean, I never found anything different. If something's changed inside completely, I don't know. But, you know, and I was never afraid of driving. I was never afraid of doing things after, like, you know, different than I was before, you know.
Yeah.
But what I can say is that it changed me on my life. So I respect my life, but I think the life of the people in a much better way compared to I was respecting before. You know, so if this changed something on driving, I don't know. But I mean, for sure, I respect much more our life, the life of the people as well, you know. So this is something that, I mean, I look to that in the much more, you know, I respect more our life compared to what I was doing before. which is this is something that he changed. Yeah. Because you never expect that, I mean, a big accident will happen to you. Even if it happens to others, oh, somebody has an accident, but you never expect to feel that, you know? And I think when you feel that, you really, respect more, yeah. To be honest, you know?
Yeah, you have a sense of your mortality, I suppose.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
So just to finish, you've had, such a stellar career, Grand Prix victories, your early career in karting with your father and the single seaters in Italy, Formula 3000, more recently Formula E. Is there a period that you look back on most fondly? Is it walking into Ferrari for the first time or winning the first Grand Prix? Or, what is it that, if you're feeling a bit down, you think back to that moment, you're like, yeah, that was pretty amazing.
I think it was so many incredible times that I have, in my career, for sure. It's so easy, to put Formula One on that. It's so easy to say, okay, my first victory in Brazil was the most incredible feeling that I never expect to have, but I mean, going back, I had many incredible moments feeling, I never thought that I was going to have that, even before Formula One, when I didn't have the money to race, and then I win and I go there and I win like in the massive time. When I won the Italian European Championship in Formula Renault in Valencia, I think, on that weekend, I was feeling exactly the same as my weekend in Interlagos 2008. And it was unbelievable how strong I was and, how I managed, to put everything together, put in the perfect way, so strong, so, aggressive as well in the important times. So at the end, that time was also very important for me, but also many incredible races I had in Formula One. The first victory, but also the first time I won in Interlagos, the first pole, but also other races like, victories I had in Bahrain. It was just, I have so many incredible moments, even in Williams, my race in Abu Dhabi that I finished second, fighting even for the victory, You have so many points that, it was just well remembered.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry, there's so much we haven't talked about, but there is so much that we have covered. Felipe, thank you so much. It's been absolutely fascinating. It's so kind of you to join us all the way from Brazil and spare a whole hour of your time. It's very, very kind. So thank you from all the readers and listeners and viewers. It's been brilliant.
No, thank you, Ed. And thank you, everybody. That's amazing. We'll be listening to some nice stories from Ferrari. And it's always a great, great pleasure for me to speak about Ferrari, but also my time. During long years in my career.
Listen, we will see you all soon, or you'll hear us all soon with another series at the start of next year. I hope you've enjoyed the series. It's been absolutely fantastic for me, obviously.
Yeah.
But thank you for listening. Thank you for watching.
Thank you very much.
See you all soon. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.